Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Art of Living radio show with me, Victoria Mary Clark. And today I have as a very special guest, Rosita Sweetman, who is an author and also a journalist. Welcome, Rosita.
Thank you, Victoria.
And I've just finished reading your book. It's absolutely brilliant. I loved it.
Oh, thank you so much. Your book.
Rosita's got a book. It's called Fathers Come First, and it's about to be published this week.
It was published last Wednesday.
Last week. Yeah. By Lilliput Press. And it was originally published in 1974. So maybe tell us a little bit about the book. And I was always very curious when I was reading it, because the book is basically about a teenage girl who goes to a very Catholic school. She's educated by nuns, and she doesn't have a very happy home life. She's got a stepmother who she doesn't like. She calls her a devastating bitch. And she gets punished for that. And she finds herself, I think, really lonely, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's definitely at odds with the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, she doesn't find her niche
and then
easily.
She becomes a model.
Yeah.
But the way you describe the modelling thing, it doesn't sound like that much fun to me.
I think the thing of perhaps modelling now is more empowering.
Do you think?
But then it was like, such a minuscule little niche, you know, and you were really just trotted in, trotted out, wearing the clothes. You know, the models didn't have power, you know. That now, probably most of them still don't have any power.
I'd imagine they don't, because, I mean, unless you're at the very top.
Yeah.
You're probably just scrabbling for the same work and having to fight off other competition. And there's a lot of competition in this book, competitiveness, particularly between the women, the girls. Was that something you experienced yourself growing up?
I actually had a flashback last night to being at boarding school.
Yeah.
And it was just like, our nuns weren't actually too bad. Like, they were Sacred Heart nuns. They did want all of us to go on and do university education. And, you know, it wasn't just, you know, become a wife or, you know, become an air hostess. Like, they did actually.
Or become a nun.
Or become a nun. They did want us to become nuns.
Yeah,
you?
Yeah.
But the entire environment was female. You know, so it was like, oh my God. You know, you'd long to see a man, you know, at holidays, you know, sort of going home, you know, your brother, your dad. You know, it's like, oh my God, women don't, this little enclave of women, they don't actually control the whole world.
Yeah,
it's like an all-man environment.
Not healthy.
It's not healthy. There's two sexes for a reason, and lots of sexualities for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, that we challenge each other.
You didn't grow up as a lone child, even though your character, lead character, is an only child. You always wonder, don't you, how much of it is you? Like, I mean, there must be some similarities between you and the girl.
In some ways, there are, but in other ways, like, it was quite strange when a friend sent me a copy of the book about 4 years ago, and I hadn't sat down and read it. She was reorganising her books and just thought, oh, this, you might enjoy this. And I sat down and read it. I didn't actually recognise the girl, you know, like, it, or the situation or anything. It was huge, the gap.
Yeah, but she doesn't seem like, I've not known you very long, a few years, but you don't seem like her as a personality. Like, she's quite, I don't know, outspoken, and she strips her clothes off whenever she gets drunk. Do you do that? Did you ever do that?
Oh, we did.
Oh, you did? Oh, I see. And she drinks a lot.
Yeah.
She does. Is that also
guilty as charged?
Guilty as charged?
Yeah.
So maybe I just don't know you.
I think I'm 40 years older, I'm a mum, you know, it's like, there are parts that are parts of me, you know, which in a way all writing, all creativity. The instrument is the artist or the singer or the writer. You know, it comes through them.
Yeah.
But in other ways, the way I would write now would be much closer to the bone, much more like Michel Haneke, the filmmaker. He says, you know, as soon as you stray from the truth, you're lost.
Right.
You know, so now I'd be sort of much more rigorous in a way.
But she comes across as very real. Like, I felt myself identifying with her a lot, especially in her relationships with men. I'm sorry to say. She doesn't meet some very nice men, does she? They're very manipulative and sort of controlling of her.
Yeah.
Particularly the one that she lives with.
I think her, even though in some ways she's quite ballsy, in other ways she's her lack of confidence.
Yeah.
You know, you were saying in some ways nothing has changed. I think for, say, like Chupi's generation.
That's
and
your
Luke,
daughter, Chupi. Yeah.
And Luke, my son.
Yeah.
Like their relationships, the balance of power is so much more equal.
But that's kind of credit to you for the way you brought them up, really, isn't it? Because they seem extremely confident. They're really, like, I know people their age who are absolutely nothing like as confident and sure of themselves as Chupi and Luke. But you brought them up, you schooled them yourself.
I did.
That might have helped, do you think?
Chupi says homeschooling is a bit like swimming in the Irish Sea. It's sort of really hard while you're doing it, but you feel brilliant afterwards.
That's a great way of putting it.
But yeah, I think I'm glad I did it.
Mm.
And I think they're glad. Look, I don't think they've any regrets or...
Well, they both seem to be doing very well.
That they weren't turned into weird right-wing Christians or something. You know, like in America, homeschooling is sort of, my God. No, but... Here, there's a very small homeschooling movement, but it's quite feisty.
So you, when did you get your start? Because I know you've also written several books which would be classed, I suppose, as feminist literature. You wrote On Our Backs and you wrote On Our Knees.
Yeah.
Are they what you're most famous for, probably?
I guess, yeah at the time,
Yeah. So how did you get started in writing?
It was all... things I think were so much more unstructured then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I went to see a Francis Bacon exhibition with my dad.
Yeah.
This was the 1960s, like long, long. And he said, why don't you write something about it? He brought it in to a friend of his in the Evening Herald and they printed it.
Wow. Your dad just said to you, why don't you write something about it?
My dad was a very keen writer,
Okay.
he didn't get published, like he was a barrister, he was sort of, you know, doing it on the side, but I think I picked up.
Did he write for newspapers?
No, yeah. He didn't, no, he was, he sort of did a novel and poetry, you know.
But that's interesting that he would have suggested to you that you write something for a newspaper, and then he would have actually helped you to get it published.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I think, you know, in a big family, people get assigned different roles and possibilities. And he and I were close in some ways, and one of the ways was through books and art. So, yeah, I was lucky.
So how old were you when that happened?
I would have been about 17.
Gosh, what a thrill. What was it like?
It was an amazing thrill, yeah. And then to get a little check
and
in the
post. And they gave you money as well. Wow, how much did they give you?
I think it was 5 and 6 or something.
That was a lot of money in those days, right?
It surely was, yeah.
Yeah.
Because nobody had any money.
No.
You know, I remember Sean Hutton picking Hayden Murphy up outside McDade's and turning him up on his heels and shaking him to see if even a few pennies would come out.
So did that kickstart your writing career?
I guess it did, yeah.
Did you write any more for them? For the Herald?
No, I didn't. I actually sort of veered off then because I went to work in Amnesty in London.
Oh, wow.
They were just setting up. And then while I was in London, the BBC were looking for runners.
Yes.
And I did that. You know, when you're young, you sort of do anything,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And then 7 days, the current affairs programme was being set up back here.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to interview for that and got the job as a research assistant. And so that was sort of getting more into the media. And then Mary Kenny hired me to write for the Irish Press.
Now, there's a Mary in your novel, and it sounds, she sounds a little like Mary Kenny. Is it, did you kind of base her on Mary Kenny?
No, I didn't actually. No, and I didn't.
She
I
just
didn't
seems
make the
like very strong and very sure of herself and very forward thinking as a woman for the time.
She kind of emerged, like I remember the day Mary sort of emerged into the story. She was like the voice of feminism.
Yeah, and she's the one that tells your character that she needs to ditch the man and get her act together and stand up for herself and get her own flat and build her own life.
Yeah.
And to not be, dependent on him.
Yeah.
And your character pretty much does that. So you weren't consciously thinking of Mary Kenny?
No, though Mary Kenny has been absolutely amazing. Everything around the republication of Fathers has been rather amazing. Like when Mary heard it, we were having a women's lib lunch, and Mary said, "I'm going to do a party for you." So after the lunch, she had a little supper party up in her flat. Beside the Shelburne. It was so amazing. Like the sisters kind of, they all came, like Maureen Johnson, who's 84 now, got the bus in from Lucan, walked up to Origin. Yeah, like amazing. Nell.
Nell McCafferty?
Yeah, Marie McMahon and Anne,
Anne Harris.
Anne agreed to give the launch speech, so it felt... felt very wonderful, the sisters sort of gathering around and supporting.
Sounds great. Now we'll just take a musical break and then we will come right back with more.
Oh,
So welcome back to The Art of Living with me, Victoria Mary Clark. And today I'm talking to Rosita Sweetman, who is a writer, and she's just republished her first novel, which was your first novel in 1974, and it's now been republished by Lilliput Press, and it's called Fathers Come First. And Rosita, you were one of the founding members of the Irish Women's Liberation Organization. Can you tell me what that was like and what prompted you to do that?
It was actually a pretty extraordinary group, the IWLM. Mary Maher, who was women's editor of the Irish Times at the time, and Mary is American, and she was getting literature in from the US, but amazing things the women were doing there, you know, like really kicking up a stink and loads of direct action. So she called together a little group of women that she thought might be interested. At the beginning, it was mostly women who were working in the media.
Right.
At the time, I was working for Mary Kenny, who was running the women's page in the Irish Press.
Yes.
And then Nell McCafferty. Nell was working on the Irish Times.
Yeah.
So she came along with Mary Maher. There were all kinds of women who were making breakthroughs at the time. I suppose the original group was about 12 or 13 people. Like Mary Robinson was there.
Oh, yes.
Mary.
There's a lot of Marys in this.
There was an amazing number of Marys.
Why were there so many Marys?
I think it was
popular name.
The name at the time.
Yeah. And the rights of women were pretty bad at that time. I remember my mother telling me that once she got married, she was no longer entitled to her own property. That it then became
the
property of her husband.
Absolutely medieval.
And also you had to give up your job if you got married, most jobs, and you couldn't even rent a television without your husband or your father.
Yeah, you couldn't sign a hire purchase agreement.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
And women lost their children, not just the family home, but say the guy decided, okay, I don't want this anymore. She could be turfed out, no home, and he could keep the children.
Really?
No, it was medieval.
Yeah.
It really was medieval. Yeah.
And of course, there were you had no contraception, so you were...
Contraception was a huge thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was... Mary Robinson wasn't directly involved in sort of workshops and things, but it was all in Mrs. Guy's restaurant in Bagot Street.
Oh, yeah.
Where all the sort of lefties, everyone met, anyone who was doing anything was up in Guy's.
And did you... obviously, you must have done something, because those things are no longer true. You know, we are now allowed to own property, and we are now allowed to have contraception, and we can get divorced, and we can do all these things. Do you think we have come far enough as Irish women, or do you think there's a long way to go?
Just to go back a step first, Irish women's movement is sort of being one of the most successful social improvement movements in Ireland. There hasn't really been anything like it. Hundreds of reforms flowed from it. You know, the Rape Crisis Centre was set up, Married Women's Allowance, Widows Allowance, Deserted Parents Allowance, Battered Wives Hostels.
Mm-hmm.
Huge social change happened. And it was only really, the initial group was only really there for 9 months. But it kind of exploded. A whole lot of sacred cows got a good whacking, and things did change.
But you took a lot of flack. I remember as a small child hearing about women's lib, and it sort of being, you know, people didn't always speak about it in positive terms. You know, there were all these brow-burning feminists and...
It was extremely hostile.
Yeah. So, I mean, how did you put up with that? How did you get through that?
Sure, it was grist to the mill. You know,
really?
We were in our mid-20s, most of us, you know. It was fun.
Really?
Nobody felt put down or anything. You just think those silly old idiots, you know. Irish Women Unite invaded the 40-foot, you know.
Oh, yeah?
And all the elk fellas, you know, running up in their necks. You know, it was fun, you know.
So it wasn't as dangerous as being a suffragette?
It could get pretty rough, but I suppose we were young and full of conviction. We didn't take on board the horribleness of the other side.
Mm.
Like, I remember this march, and there were women with children in buggies, you know, to get contraception legalised. And we marched up to Dáil Éireann, and this TD came out and said, "Ye should be fucked on your hands and knees like animals, because that's all you are." I said, "Oh my God."
You know, TD?
Yeah. And like, there were little toddlers and, you know, all really nice women, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there was a lot of... It brought up a lot of anger, because I think sexuality is so screwed up in Ireland, you know. In a lot of places it's screwed up, but we had a pretty bad dose.
So you managed to make the changes that you felt were necessary. But do you think that we have made enough changes, or do you think there's still more to go?
Oh, this is the beginning.
What else would you like to see change?
I'd love to see... I'd actually love to see women running the world.
Yeah.
Because I think men have run it and run it and run it, and they've run it into the ground, you know. That maybe it'd be a good thing if women came in and said, okay, enough is enough. You know, we don't actually need to slaughter each other. We don't actually need to have people earning $400 billion every second and other people starving. You know,
yes,
like,
yes.
To run the world as a sane place.
So why are we not doing that? And why are the women of my generation and the generation after me, why are they not more politically active and, you know, taking... control?
I think sort of looking back, say the 60s and the 70s, a huge part of the liberalising of all the puritanical values that had held sway up to then have been kind of hijacked, you know. So like, you know, now young women are afraid if they haven't removed every single hair from their body.
That's very true.
You know.
Very true.
And, you know, that sort of, you know, standards from pornography moving into ordinary man-woman love, you know, or man-man love, or woman.
In some ways we've actually got worse.
In some ways it
like
has.
Like, obviously the women in your book wouldn't have even been thinking about that, would they?
No.
I mean, obviously they did. They waxed their legs, but that was about it, really.
Yeah. And that'd only be for special occasions.
And they didn't need fake tan.
No, it was pre-that.
Pre-fake tan. But they did diet a lot.
They did.
So nothing's changed in that department. They're still dieting.
Absolutely.
Did you actually model yourself?
I did for a very short time, yeah.
So you got to see what it was like?
Yeah, I was really at the, you know, for a shop sort of state. You know, I never did anything big.
But like when you look at advertisements for beauty products and magazines and stuff now, do you feel that anything has improved in our kind of approach, or how we look at women as objects of beauty or not beauty? Depending on like how much they spend on stuff. Do you think anything's improved since that time?
In a way, the standards have become more ferocious.
Yeah.
For women, you know, they have to, you know, go out to work, look beautiful, have babies, you know, have affairs, have husbands.
They have to do everything.
Clean the toilet. But in other ways, huge gains for women, I think. It's the confidence thing, you know, like we were sort of talking feminism but still living, you know, as pre-feminist women in a way when it came to men.
You got married quite young.
I did, yeah. And my ex was a good bit older. And
was he bossy? I know you're not allowed to say too much, but was he kind of like the guys in your book?
He was, yeah.
Bossy.
Male chauvinist.
Yes. But like one point that you make that I think very important in the book is that people will do a lot and put up with a lot in order to not have to feel lonely. And it looks like, you know, that doesn't seem to have changed. I mean, the character in your book stays with this guy who's a bit of an asshole, basically, because she doesn't want to be on her own.
She's afraid of that.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that is ever going to change?
I think it's changed absolutely radically. If you look at, divorce and separation being made more available Something like 98% of marriages or relationships are ended by the woman who finally says, okay, that is it, you know. Because men will go on, you know, as long as they possibly can, you know. But I think, you know, if you see the number of marriages that are ending, you know, whereas 50 years ago they stayed and stayed and stayed and that was really crap, you know, So many women ended up having breakdowns or men being utterly miserable, you know, inside a loveless marriage. I think it's changed.
So you think people are less afraid to be on their own for a while, or they might take a chance? And
less afraid to bust up a marriage if it's really toxic and horrible. You know, maybe a bit too easy to break it off. As well, but
I suppose in the celebrity world, you married them, you know, and then 3 months later, it doesn't matter if you break up, it's not really important. But what about you? Did you ever marry again?
No, I didn't.
You didn't. Would you again?
I wouldn't have problems about it in the sense of equality or.
You would, okay.
If somebody that asked. I thought was, yeah.
Good. Really, I just wanted to say, because we're nearly out of time, but that really your book is amazing and I think everyone should read it. And it's it's a fun read, but it's really moving and it just, I don't know, it's just brilliant.
Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for talking.
And we'll be back on The Art of Living next week. Thank you for listening.